Hello, Anchorage. This is Deb the Librarian. You're listening to Informania, and today I'm fortunate to have guest Professor Shannon Gramsci, who's also a published author and poet.
Hi, Deb.
Hi.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad you're here. So first of all, tell us your background, your path here to the university. You're a writing professor here, and give us some little bit of your experience and expertise.
I came to Anchorage 29 years ago to write poetry, really, and I joined the MFA program here at UAA and never left. I remember my first day. I came into this building, actually, and went up to the English department on the second floor then, and they said they were needing a teaching assistant. Someone had just quit, and the semester was about to begin, and they were desperate to take anybody. And so that's how I got my start at UAA. And it had been an aspiration for some time in my life to be a teacher and a writer. And I never thought I'd be so fortunate as to have it happen in Alaska. But here, almost 30 years later, it worked out.
So when did you first discover that you liked writing? Was it when you were a child? When it was it in school?
I'm not sure. Yeah, I think I've long preferred written communication to spoken communication here as I'm on the radio, right? I think I'd be more comfortable if we were doing this interview over email. I like the consideration that comes with writing. And I guess my parents and teachers had always encouraged me to write. I think of a joke or a cartoon I share with my students sometimes at UAA. It's a New Yorker cartoon from I don't know when, and the teacher's handing back a paper to the student. It has an A on it, and the teacher says, "Oh, you're a really good writer," and the caption under it says, "And so my life was ruined." You know, I think it's not a career that is very lucrative. A lot of people struggle in it. But I've always enjoyed both writing and teaching. I'm not the kind of teacher who would rather just be writing all the time. I really enjoy teaching just as much as writing. So I guess it was in college I really started to write poetry and looked at some of my writing professors and thought, oh, that seems like a really interesting life to help people learn to write during the academic year and then have a summers to do my own writing, right? And that's something I really thought looked like an interesting career path.
And where did you go to school?
I went to St. Olaf College in Minnesota. Yeah, I'm an undergraduate in UAA, and I'm a UAA graduate. And like I say, I just arrived here. I made a big move when I was 24 years old from Minnesota to Alaska and came to UAA and I met my wife here, and now we've raised our daughter essentially on campus and live less than a mile from campus, and it's become my second home.
And you got a degree here,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
What was your area of research interest?
Poetry, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you have to decide on a particular style, or could you explore it all?
You know, it's funny. I didn't look into the program here one bit. I just knew I wanted to come to Alaska. And I looked at Fairbanks, and I thought that seemed a little cold, and so settled on Anchorage and studied with Linda McCarriston, who was the poet here at the time, and didn't expect to, in Alaska, encounter a fiery Marxist feminist writer, but it was really shaped me a lot to study with her that apprenticeship. And I wasn't even sure why I chose poetry, really. I thought if I could figure out how to write poetry, then I could figure out any other type of writing. It seemed like that would be the most challenging style or genre. I've always been attracted to, in the artistic sense, the plastic sense, we would say, of poetry, that making a poem is like making a sculpture or a painting, and that creative element to it. And of course, writing stories or novels is also very creative. But there's something about poetry, that artistic sense, that how the poem looks and shaping that in that kind of plastic sense, that it really appeals to me. The music of it, of course, as well.
So it sounds like your professor challenged you.
Yeah, we became good friends as well. But yeah, it wasn't what I expected. I got to know Tom Sexton later. He had just retired right before I arrived here, and I expected more of that, of the sort of stereotypical cabin poet. John Haynes was another person I admired and got to know in Alaska. And so Linda McCarriston brought a different vision of social responsibility and justice and a kind of political perspective that I think has definitely infused my work beyond just, writing haiku about snow falling in your cabin seems kind of mundane after you study with someone like Linda McCarriston.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful to be challenged at the university, and I think that's one of the blessings.
Yeah.
And you're right, you can go in with a kind of a stereotype of what poetry is, but to be exposed to all of these different perspectives and to be pushed a little bit harder in different areas too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that poetry can present a scene, can present an emotion without being a novel. You know what I mean? In a very few words. I mean, I've just, reading your book, Last Poems, and some of the poems in here, it's phenomenal.
Thanks.
I mean, there's so much to even one of your poems, that it takes a while to digest. I almost want to go camping and just sit with it, because there's a lot in there, and we'll get into that a little bit later.
Thanks. That's good to hear. Poetry asks a lot of the reader, and I think people are intimidated by it sometimes. But I think if you just sit with it or read it multiple times and trust your instinct, and rather than trying to figure out what it means or what the author intended, just to think about how it makes you feel. And then I think in that repeated reading, if it encourages you to go back, and maybe you're not sure exactly what's going on, but you go back and you read and you see more and more of the layers and more of the design and the artistry in it. That's, I think, one of the hallmarks of poetry, that when you read it, you really say, I want to read that again, or I want to read that out loud, or I want to go camping with it and sit with this for a while. And like I say, that's not everyone wants to do that, and our culture works against that as well. We want the quick version of things. We want the executive summaries of things. We don't want to sit with it and really stew with it. But I think poetry is one of those things that brings us back to that.
So for listeners that want to pursue writing here, what opportunities are available now?
Here at UAA?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we offer a minor in creative writing in the English department. We no longer have a graduate program. That went the way of budget cuts. Unfortunately, I think that's a big mistake. And of course, we offer a OEC, Occupational Endorsement Certificate in Writing as well. And that's a joint project between my department and the English department. So any student, if they want to study writing in more depth, that's an opportunity. And of course, all of our bachelor-seeking students are required to take 2 semesters of writing. And I always tell students, and I'm biased because that's what I do, but I always tell students that that's very much worth their time. That it's changing a little bit in the world of AI, but I still am confident that our ability to read and write and think critically and with confidence is something that's valued in every career and is part of what makes us human.
So, if students want to write, go into the writing field, where does the line happen between writing and English?
Yeah.
At the university?
It's a really good question. English is a huge tent, right? English includes linguistics and film studies, and oftentimes when we start talking about literature and critical theory, we suddenly get into women's studies and post-colonial studies and history, and my book is a lot about history. And so the lines are fuzzy. The Department of Writing spun off from the English department about 7 years ago, and we teach all of the GER courses, the pre-GER courses, the GER courses, and also some special topics courses that veer into, and I'm making air quotes here on the radio, they veer into creative writing territory. But the creative writing classes that are under a different prefix in the university are still housed in the Department of English. And
So would it be, could they pursue an interdisciplinary degree under creative writing?
Yeah, you could put that together for sure. Yeah.
So there is kind of
a pathway.
You could. I don't know if students are doing that as much as some of the more technical fields for that kind of option.
In general, you know, the degrees in the humanities are in huge decline since the 2000s or so.
But yet the interest and the need isn't.
Exactly.
You know, that's what's so mind-blowing to me.
Yeah. And again, maybe I'm biased because I'm in this side of the world, but I think in an increasingly data-driven, technical, AI-shaped world, I think we're positioned for a resurgence in the humanities. I think those things don't go away, and maybe they become more valuable than ever.
Absolutely. So who do you think has inspired you the most in regard to your writing?
It's an interesting question. I'm going to do an event at the Writer's Block on Wednesday night. It's called Poetry Parley. So this question has been on my mind. The setup of Poetry Parley is they ask a writer to come and read, but then also to talk about and read a poet who has inspired them. And a poet that has meant a lot to me, a controversial poet from the 20th century, is a man named Ezra Pound. I did an in-depth study of him and have come back to his life and his approach to poetry over and over again. And I could talk about that for 2 hours and bore your readers to death. But Ezra Pound is a fascinating character. He was born in Idaho in 1885 and died in Italy in 1972. Just a year after I was born. And he, it's interesting, and I say that because his work seems to be almost from a different age. He is credited with developing really our modern sense of poetry, of imagistic poetry, of free verse poetry. He was right in the mix with that and influenced many of the great 20th century writers, but yet is relatively unknown or unread. People know his name and people talk about his influence, but very few people sit and read his work, in part because it's very difficult. His life's work, the Cantos, is in 20 different languages and is this epic tale of humanity. And there's long sections in it that I find unreadable as well, on monetary theory or obscure pieces of history. It's talking about poetry, asking a lot of the reader. It's really intense. But so much of the spirit of his work has informed my work. For one example, is he really talked about and lived a life where, as a young writer, he said you should really promote the work of others and focus on translation. So this is my first book of my own work, but I've published several books of other people's work. And I co-founded a journal called Ice Flow that you probably remember that ran for a dozen years, where it was publishing poetry from around the circumpolar north and in English translation and the original language. And I was involved in many of those translations in a collaborative way. And that was inspired by Ezra Pound, the idea of really putting other people's work first and learning through translation. Because when you're translating poetry, is incredibly difficult, and you really think about how you can transplant the language, the feel of the language, the ideas from one language to another, which is somewhat impossible. And so that kind of negotiation you go through in translating, I think, is an excellent instruction for your own poetry. People used to say to me in Ice Flow, like my parents, I think, are listening tonight in Minnesota, say, how come you don't publish your own work in that? And I said, no, this is, you know, about promoting the work of others and my own training as a poet, and not rushing that. And I, you know, imagine what a different world we would have if writers spent as much energy promoting the work of others as they do promoting themselves. And so that's an example of how Ezra Pound really influenced me. He was a controversial figure. He did radio broadcasts during World War II in Italy against the United States, and was tried for treason after the war, and would have potentially been executed for that, but then was found. Some of his friends, like Robert Frost and famous people, intervened on his behalf and had him declared insane. And so he spent, I think, more than 10 years in insane asylum, which would have been like his prime years as a poet, right? But living literally in an old school insane asylum to avoid prison or potentially execution. He's a controversial figure, but didn't back away from his vision for what he saw poetry as the way we shape civilizations, the way we, he talked about the tale of the tribe, right? He wanted to use poetry to direct the future and to educate people. And so I found that very inspiring.
So if you could recommend one poem from Ezra Pound for people to wow. consider reading.
The first canto, yeah, canto number one would be a great one to read. It's actually, a loose translation of a scene from the Odyssey. It's a loose translation of a translation of the Odyssey that he then runs to amazing places, and it's a beautiful poem. I'll read it on Wednesday night at the Writer's Block if anyone is out there interested. But that would be a good one to get a sense of the depth and the lyricism in Ezra Pound.
I mean, the name implies song.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Right? Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yep. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Yep. Yeah, he's a fascinating character. Amazing, amazing person.
Do you think he ever put those to song, to music?
I've heard recordings of him where there's a drum in the background, and he had a very dramatic way of reading, too. It sounds like someone from another time, and I guess 100 years ago is another time, but rolling the R's in a very, very dramatic presence, and sometimes with the drum. I don't know of musical adaptations. There probably are.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we've got to go to a break. I'm talking with Shannon Gramsci. He's a writing professor and a poet at the University of Alaska Anchorage. You're listening to Informania. This is Depth the Librarian. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Informania. This is Depth the Librarian. I'm talking with Shannon Gramsci. He is a professor of writing here at the University of Alaska Anchorage and a poet. His new book is Lost Last Poems. Now, you've been writing poetry for decades then, right?
Correct.
I should say for 5 years.
Yeah, a lot longer than that. Yeah.
I would hate for someone to throw that question at me.
So. Yeah.
We're experienced around here.
Yeah.
How far back do the poems in this book go, and what was your inspiration to finally publish?
Yeah, the poems in this book go back over the last 10 years or so. I did reach back deeper for one of the poems, On a Lark. As I was putting the book together, you were asking about how they're ordered and such, and we'll talk about the design of that. And I had a kind of spot I wanted to fill, and so I did reach back to a much older poem and I revised it extensively. But otherwise, over the last 10 years or so. And what inspired me is I, as I said, I've been more interested in promoting the work of others and in translation than in getting myself out there. I am somewhat of a reluctant player in the publishing game, or as Linda McCarrison used to say, the po-biz, right? And it's a complicated thing to try to explain, but I especially writing poetry, I've sometimes wondered what's the point of publishing, honestly, especially publishing in journals, like the journal I used to run. It just seems like such a niche audience. I just wondered sometimes about the value of that. I always love to write. I love to write for myself. I love to create these things and make these worlds that I could inhabit and learn from. But I wasn't in a rush to publish. And it's something that John Haynes talked to me about when I was young and in Alaska. John Haynes, who, for those of you who don't know, was at the time, you know, one of the foremost poets ever to live in Alaska. And he had talked about really not rushing into publication. It's not difficult to get your work published if you're persistent, but being published doesn't necessarily mean you've accomplished very much, really. And so I was patient with that. A friend of mine is a singer-songwriter, and he convinced me to put this book together. He was irritated with me because I was sending him poems, just sharing as a friend, and he said, you know, he'll get up at a coffee shop or at a bar and sing his songs and perform, and he was really irritated that I was keeping this to myself and wasn't taking that other step. And so he really pushed me to think about publishing the work. And I didn't shop the manuscript around. I only sent it to two places, both Alaskan presses. I just didn't want to play that game. I find that somewhat unbecoming of the kind of art I want to make, honestly, that kind of self-promotion. I can't imagine Ezra Pound doing that, for example, right? So I take myself a little too seriously, but I only sought like a local press, and I'm happy with that.
Wonderful. Was it a difficult business to in putting it together? Like, did the editor come back and say, "Oh, well, you've got to do this," or
yeah?
What was that process like?
It's funny you ask, and I'll just say this: I originally thought that the University of Alaska Press, I wrote this kind of for them. And I thought that they might take a look at it since I'm a faculty member here. And they did, and they were very interested in the book, but strung it along for like 2 years without saying yes or no, and was getting good peer reviews. And then one of the peer readers read it and didn't like the way the book was framed. It's got a sort of fictional, metapoetic frame to it, and really was offended by that. And then UA Press stopped returning my emails. So then I turned to Circ Press, is another Alaska press, a regional press. They publish work from the Pacific Northwest. And they were really excited about the book, and really, they said, really honored to have it. And so that made me feel good. That was.
Well, your writing is phenomenal. I mean, the descriptions you have in here, the stories you tell, the experiences you reflect on, I mean, the way you incorporate nature and, I mean, it's very beautiful. And the struggles, excuse me.
Thanks.
Yeah.
That's nice to hear.
So you get published. Now, let's talk about the structure of this. Like, how did you decide on the order? Because it's like, and also, like, go ahead and share a little bit about your experience in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Because you definitely tell some wonderful stories about that.
It's a complicated book, and it's explaining poetry is a little bit like explaining a joke, right? It sort of takes something away, and also I believe that the author's intent isn't always the most important piece, but I'll tell you a little bit, with both of those caveats, I'll tell you a little bit about my thinking here. The book is, I think of the book as a single poem, actually. I intended it to be that way. I intended it to be a single work that has a sense of continuity and flow to it. The poems are organized alphabetically by the title, by the titles, and every letter of the alphabet is represented, A through Z. And this one of the framing tropes of the book is that these poems are not actually mine, but were found on a thumb drive by a student who gave them to me. The opening, there's a foreword in the book, which is actually, I consider, a poem, but the very first poem in the book is a foreword purportedly by me, the writing professor, about how a student found this thumb drive with a bunch of alphabetized poems on it, and the writing professor in it starts to read and finds them charming and then publishes the book. And actually people have been, I said that a reader from the U of A Press was offended by that because I make fun of writers in it. And another person I sent a blurb to believed it and said, "Well, I don't think you should publish this book because these poems aren't yours." And I thought, gosh, So it's a complicated. And so what am I trying to do there? In a way, I think joking around a little bit. Writers take themselves so seriously. And so I think opening with a tongue-in-cheek move like that was interesting. But there's also some deadly serious things in there. You know, it's not a new idea that we should try to separate the text that a writer writes from the writer, right? In a way, I think all poems are persona poems, right? Where that's the writer in these poems is me, but also isn't me. And so much of our work today in poetry is really dominated by the identity of the author and celebrating their identity. And I think there's some value in that, but we've really gotten away from the idea that, in a way, the identity of the author also shouldn't really matter. And what the author thinks the poem is about is not the final say. Really, that's up to you, the reader, to decide. So I wanted to play with that. I also kind of had like a Blair Witch Project idea. Remember that old movie mm-hmm. where they find these tapes, right? And that sets it apart. It sets the work apart as a bunch of words, a bunch of letters and a bunch of words. And I think to set that off as an artifact, I think was interesting. Finally, I think one of the journeys in this book and relates to my time in Vietnam is an exploration of Buddhism and the Buddhist sense of non-self, which again I think circles back to this idea of where if we're always celebrating ourselves and talking about ourselves, I think there's a sense of vanity in that that I don't know is always productive. If I was a painter and all I did is paint pictures of myself, you'd think I was vain, right? And I think a lot of poets, it ends up being me, my vision, my voice, my special view of things. And I wanted to kind of move past that. And so that's kind of the way it's framed. And that's why the poems are alphabetized, because ostensibly that was somewhat random. That's just how they were in the thumb drive. However, in real life, right, they are my poems, and that foreword is a lie, and the alphabetization of the titles was a puzzle that I had to work very carefully on. It's not random at all. It's very intentional, as I say, as a single work of one thing leading to another and incorporating these different themes, which you ask about. I view it as sort of three legs to the stool. One of them is, I think, a sort of Baroque history of colonialism in Alaska. And the other is, I think, some interesting parallels I try to draw with the history of Vietnam. And we know how colonialism in Vietnam, imperialism in Vietnam worked out. It left a national scar for the United States. We lost more than 50,000 Americans there, and in the process killed more than 3 million Vietnamese. And it's something that we still are struggling with as a country. I think many people think the sort of social and political divisions that we struggle with today draw some of their roots from those times in the 60s around that conflict. And so it's one of the suggestions in there is that that kind of imperialism, that kind of will to dominate, to control, to terrorize, which I think is a history here in Alaska of those things is connected to that same kind of impulse in Vietnam. The third leg of the stool is me trying to make a home in a place like this and trying to be a dad in a place like this. And so there's a kind of placemaking. And as a colonizer, right here, where I'm teaching English in Alaska, I'm not Alaska native, right? I've come here as an outsider. And so trying to make peace with that and figure out how to move forward. So that's kind of how I imagine it. I don't know how other people might imagine it. The front cover of the book is a picture from the 1920s of a coal mine in Vietnam. And I think it's a stunning image. When I first saw it, I thought, I really want to make that a cover of a book. It's amazing, these shelves that have been created in this open pit coal mine. And you look more closely at it and you see there's people working, tiny wow. people that have yeah. carved this out of a solid mountain. And very much exploitive labor. The history of the way the French exploited the Vietnamese they were there from the 1850s to the 1950s. The history of the way they exploited the Vietnamese is really a stunning thing to think about. And then, of course, leads right into our involvement in the war. The back cover, then, is meant to parallel that. This was the first oil rig in Alaska, down in the Prince William Sound area, actually, also from the 1920s. And so the suggestion is that these are sort of mirror images of each other what I find is an interesting way. I didn't intend for the book to be like this. I originally was going to write sort of a gothic history of Alaska, sort of a surrealist gothic history of Alaska. I've been really fortunate in my time in Alaska to work with a lot of Alaska Native students and spend a lot of time in rural Alaska. For 7 years, I worked for Cook Inlet Tribal Council for UAA, at UAA, but employed by the Tribal Council. And so through those experiences, really learned a lot. And I wanted to write a sort of white guy's history of Alaska who's learned about some of those hard truths originally. But then, as you allude, for the last 6 years, my family and I have been spending a lot of time in Vietnam. And that's really been an amazing experience. Actually, I think my time in rural Alaska prepared me for my time in Vietnam, to be comfortable being uncomfortable, to be comfortable in an environment where I'm very much an outsider. And so that became then a big part of my mindset writing this book, is adding this other piece to it. I don't know if that, again, it's, I hope the poems are better than my explanations of them, but that's kind of my thinking.
Yeah, before I go into more questions about the poems, you've brought up your experience in Vietnam. Could you expand on what you did there?
Yeah. It's a long story as well. In 2019, my wife, Sarah Kirk, who's also a professor here at UAA, she had a sabbatical to go to Vietnam to teach English teachers and develop curriculum there. She has an expertise in ESL instruction. And so we spent 2019 and 2020 living in Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam. Our daughter was in sixth grade at the time and went to an international school. And it was an amazing, amazing experience. We really fell in love with the place and the culture. And so then COVID came. We were there actually for the beginning of COVID, which was also fascinating to see how people there were navigating those challenges versus how we are reading about what was happening at home. And then as soon as COVID allowed, we started going back. And we go back now whenever we get a break from UAA. And I've been volunteering there, teaching in a nationwide, it's called the House of Wisdom and Compassion Books. It's an organization that they open small community learning centers in all over Vietnam, in schools and apartments and prisons, and also libraries, trying to encourage literacy. And then that has led me to do more work in universities. This last summer I taught in Hanoi, at Hanoi University of Business and Technology. I taught a writing and critical thinking course there. It was really also drawing on Alaskan experiences and parallels with Vietnam. The course was about, students were writing, but what we were writing about, the intersection of globalism and traditional culture. And, you know, there's tensions there. Like in Alaska, I think people in Vietnam are concerned that as they become more cosmopolitan, they don't want to lose what makes them distinctively Vietnamese. And so we talked about issues around that and made some parallels with Alaska. And again, looking at Alaska Native traditions, we have, you know, organizations here like Trickster Company out of Southeast Alaska that is, you know, making modern designs using ancient Tlingit iconography, so bringing old forms into new into new applications, and so things like that. I intend to go back, basically whenever I get a break from UAA. I miss the summers in Alaska, but it's just been such an incredible experience. I'm learning Vietnamese. I speak maybe Vietnamese like a 5-year-old, maybe that's generous, maybe more like a 3-year-old. But it's been incredible. And through that, I've made a lot of relationships and connections. Last year, a delegation of diplomats came to UAA, and you were gracious enough to give a tour of the library to them. 2 weeks ago, I met the president of Vietnam. when he transited through Anchorage, going home from the UN, and a group of UAA students with Vietnamese roots and their families, and I and my family, a group of 20 of us, met the president of Vietnam and spent a couple of hours with him.
Amazing.
Yeah, so it's really been an incredible experience, and I think my next book I'll probably focus more on Vietnam and what I've been learning there and exploring. As you know, when you travel and you see new things and meet new people and new experiences, you really, so many of your senses come alive, and I think it's really inspiring as an artist. You know, sometimes Alaska is an incredibly beautiful place, but sometimes I don't even see things anymore because I've been here for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And going to a new place really opens up my eyes and my ears and my senses, and I think I get a lot of poems out of that.
Wonderful. So we have to go to another break. I'm talking with Shannon Gramsci. He's a professor of writing here at the University of Alaska Anchorage and an amazing poet, author of Lost Last Poems. You're listening to Informania. This is Deb the Librarian. We'll be back shortly. Welcome back to Informania. This is Deb the Librarian. I'm talking with Shannon Gramsci, a professor of writing at the University of Alaska Anchorage and author of Lost Last Poems. Now, he had mentioned in the previous segment about how he sets this structure for the book, introducing himself as having found the poems on a flash drive in the foreword. And I was just making the comment during the break that it's a lesson to be learned that you should always read the foreword. There's a purpose for the foreword of a book. It kind of sets up the structure of the book.
Yeah. You know, and I think poetry, ultimately, one of the things poetry does is it meditates on language and how language works, the various ways that words mean, from the connotation and the denotation, of course, but to the sounds of the words, the way they flow together, the way they look on the page. There's so many elements to it, and I think that's one of the points I wanted to get in this book is as a meditation on words, and I wanted to set it off that way, that in a way this is, a lot of the poems are true. There's poetic license, of course, but the poems are true, but they're wrapped in a lie. And I think there's a metaphor there about language as well. There's some truth to it, but you kind of have to get through all of the deceit that's built into the way we use language. So, yeah, I think it's funny. I think it's hilarious. The foreword talks about what terrible people writers are, and how scoundrels they are, and it's better not to know. And my friend Tom Sexton and I used to joke about this, that we used to say sometimes it's better just the book on the shelf, but once you meet a writer, you think, oh, the guy's kind of a jerk, actually, right? And so I'm kind of joking about that, and I think some writers don't like that. I think that's like a magician giving up the tricks, right? Is that actually we're all a bunch of selfish jerks, and it's better if you never meet us. And so that's part of the joke, I think, of that. For a bunch of self-serious poets, I think that's
so
funny.
I suppose there's some truth in some cases for that, but
present company accepted.
Exactly.
And I joke about that. I say in the foreword, I say, of course, this author is not so terrible,
no.
But we must know that most authors are not to be trusted.
So it's interesting because if you didn't know that it was alphabetical, like you kind of question, like you go between Alaska, and Vietnam. And, I mean, there's reflection on shamanism, and there's a story about hunting and, you know, just varying topics. It ebbs and flows. And I mean, how did you make that manageable? How did you manage that and find rhythm in putting all of these different pieces of your life and experience together?
It is a lot of work. It's a lot of thinking. And I hope that a person might not even notice that it's alphabetical, but then looking back, oh my gosh, it's alphabetical, and I say every letter is there. And it was a stretch. I remember toward the end I had to figure out X and J. There were a few letters that I had to work to, because I had to write poems specifically to fit those blanks. But again, that goes back to the language piece, right? There's a metaphor there, I think, about the way language works. That's why I wanted that alphabetized. And I I shaped it so that, yeah, we're going back and forth, jumping through time and place, but trying to highlight these connections between the history in Alaska and the history in Vietnam, and then my experience as someone who's complicit in that, and yet is trying to be a dad, trying to be a good guy, and trying to live a life, and
right.
wrapping up that all together.
Sorry about interrupting.
No, that's okay.
You reminded me of like the poem where you're reflecting on paradise, like with your child, and yet at the same time, in the wake of terrorism and violence and
mass shootings.
And yes.
Yeah. So there's a lot of those contemporary concerns in there as well. It's a little, like I say, it's hard to describe. I hope mm-hmm. that someone reads this and all of that is spinning around in their head in some
Clearly
meaningful
it is.
Way.
So how did you come up with the title?
The title is also a bit of a joke. I think it's funny to call my first book my last book. And the idea of being lost is a reference to this idea. Well, in the trope is that was the name of the thumb drive, right, that my student found, which of course is not true. And so part of the thought in this is that whoever wrote this threw these poems away and gave up and was disgusted with himself as an author, as if the words had failed. And I'll tell listeners on KRUA, there's a bit of an Easter egg in this book. In the foreword, I describe that the student found the thumb drive on Tenaya Peak while snowboarding. That's a range here in the Front Range, or a mountain here in the Front Range, in the Chugach Front Range. It's actually on military land, but near Chugach State Park. People don't actually snowboard there. And the very last line in the book circles back to the beginning of the book in that I reference the Denaina name for that mountain, which I won't try to pronounce the Denaina, but in English it means crying ridge. It was a place of mourning in Denaina culture. The name Tenaya Peak, which is a misspelling of Denaina, was given by the Alaska Mountaineering Society in the 1960s. And so there's a circular setup there, like a Mobius strip as well. So the idea is that whoever wrote these poems gave up and out of shame, out of frustration, threw them away, and they're lost. And of course, they're not really lost because now they're published, and they're not really my last poems, I hope, but sometimes I wonder. And so this, it's complicated. Yeah.
Well, will you read for us?
I'd happy to. I'm not sure. It's also hard to excerpt something like this, right? This is mm-hmm. complicated. Another thing I'll say, too, I just like to say this when I'm reading, is I think a lot of modern poetry, Ezra Pound included, is written in part for how it looks on the page. You know, there are rhyming poems in this book, and there's poems in meter in this book, but most modern poetry really is a free verse, right? And so I think when you just read it on radio or in a bookstore or something, I think a lot of times you miss out on that, right? And so I just want to mention that before I read anything that I'm not sure what to read. I marked some things I thought might come up in our conversation. Maybe an Alaskan poem?
Yes.
Yeah. This one is, again, you won't know this on the radio, but it's 4 17-line blocks, and it's about the first martyr in North America. And it's another thing I do in this book is play with speculative history. There's things in this book that are not true. There's true history, and then there's also sort of invented history. And in this book, in this poem, I'm playing with some of the stories about the first martyr in North America, now known as St. Juvenal. So the name of this poem is Four Martyrdoms of St. Juvenal, Proto-Martyr of America, circa 1795. Juvenal lived with Indians in the woods near Lake Iliamna, helped by a boy named Nikita, who had been kidnapped by Russians and had learned his language. Juvenal taught about a sower of seeds, lost sheep, and the Lamb of God. When the chief asked to be baptized along with his wives, Juvenal praised God, but said righteous men take only one wife or none, and then the chief and his people laughed. Winter was drawing near. The creeks were still full of fish, but mottled now and slow, with pieces of flesh falling off. Then Juvenal awoke one cold night to a woman in his bed. She was warm and soft, her touch a lamp under a bushel. The next day, when Juvenal walked to the forest to cut wood, he heard girls giggling. As he was carving a bolt for his door, a woman, maybe it was her, looked in and laughed bitterly. The next day, the chief and his men came calling. They spit on Juvenal and his icons, ripped his vestments, and bashed in his brain with a bone club as the boy named Nikita cried. That's part one. Part two. Juvenal arrived in a rowboat at the mouth of the Kuskokwim. His helper, maybe it was Nikita, was rowing as Juvenal stood and made the sign of the cross, thanking God for safe passage. A party of seal hunters was hauled out on the beach nearby. They rushed to the water's edge and waved the aliens away, but his helper kept rowing and Juvenal kept crossing himself, thanking God and blessing the shouting hunters on the shore. They thought Juvenal was swatting flies, and as he came closer, they saw his vestments and chain around his neck and mistook him for a strange shaman. They readied their arrows, shouting at Juvenal and his helper to go away, but the boy kept rowing. Arrows rained on the rowboat and pierced Juvenal in his arms, chest, and neck. He fell down dead on top of boxes in the boat as the boy leapt overboard and swam underwater. The hunters launched kayaks to spear him like a seal. That night, a shaman took Juvenal's brass cross off its chain and he rose into the air. 200 years later, the people still spoke of this day with sadness. Part 3. Juvenal lived with Eskimos on the tundra in Quinnahock. Thanks to a man who learned some Russian from traders down the coast, creative play-acting, and scraps of Yupik he began to acquire, Juvenal told the assembled village stories of risen dead, water walking, and bread and fishes. Juvenal eventually baptized every soul, young and old, and he grew to love them all for their gentle grace. Children followed him on his rounds, and he taught them to sing a few hymns. But children need to read and write to know God's light, so Juvenal dispatched a messenger to find a trader to send for a ship, and he informed their parents that the children must go to Kodiak for school. They all cried no, but agreed for God's sake. The day the ship came, Juvenal led the children to the coast, and there the parents fell on him, beating him wildly. They left him dead, but he rose, asking why, so they beat him again. Again he rose, so they chopped him up as a column of light shone down. Part 4. Juvenal soon began to listen and learn more than he taught. The children helped him study Yupik, and a shaman showed him a model of the universe. The masked dancing, dismissed initially as deviltry, was actually, despite his clumsiness, fun, and the people he came to know were kind as any Christian. The seals and salmon really did seem to sacrifice themselves so the people might live. And at the bladder festival, Juvenal launched an inflated, dried seal bladder to float on the waves and watched for the longest time as it drifted out, smaller and smaller, as the spirit guest headed home to be born again. Juvenal knelt on the tundra in awe of the sedges and lichens, all those tiny leaves and shoots interwoven. And when great flocks of geese and cranes and ducks filled the autumnal air, he watched them pass in a kind of trance until the children tugged his robes and teased him tenderly about his beard. He wondered what he would become following such a flock rather than tending one, so one blustery day he walked away. That's an Alaska poem. Wow. About, you know, the coming of Christianity to Alaska. And again, the first three are drawn from oral traditions or a hoax book that was published. And I have notes section in the back of this as well. The foreword that's supposedly written by me, but is really written by me, but a persona of me also provides all these annotations in the back. So the first three sections are based on oral traditions and other stories about this first martyr in America, and then the last one is my my
It's interesting
my
how,
wish.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting how, I mean, it's tragic, you know, how each ends in violence.
Except for the last.
Except for the last.
Yeah, yes. When he learns to listen.
Yes. I love that.
Beautiful. We're almost out of time. Can I read a Vietnam one?
Yes, please.
Real quick here. Here's one. I don't write about the Vietnam War directly. That's someone else's book to write, but I write about the impacts of it as I experienced as an American there. And people there have been very gracious to show us many, many special things, and I think it's really important for them to show us. This is called Victory at Dong Lok Junction. Dong Lok Junction was a place on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. It was bombed heavily during the war. During the war, we dropped more bombs on Vietnam than all of World War II. Victory at Dong Lok Junction. On another occasion, they took us to the graves of 10 young women, sublimated by one-ton general-purpose bomb while keeping a road alive, deep in the season of general-purpose bomb rain. Someone had left 10 sets of paper floral pajamas. We bowed and lit incense for the photographers. My family and our party moved on while I stayed with a star high school student interpreter and a pockmarked National Monument guide in green, quoting from letters to worried mothers at home. We wept together briefly, I mostly for my daughter. The guide pointed to two pigeons alighting nearby. On our way back to the van, a pair of buses rolled up, and 100 kids in red scarves enveloped us, so many little hands reaching as if we came to help.
Wow, beautiful. So, you're very talented. this book, Last Poems by Shannon Gramsci, is quite an amazing collection of poems and insights and, gosh, just a emotional processing.
It's a lot.
It's a lot.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. And I want to thank the Alaska Center for the Book as well for inviting this conversation to be part of Alaska Book Week. I think they do amazing work. And in a time where the majority of Americans read below the sixth grade level, I think that the work that they do promoting literacy in Alaska and the love of books is really profoundly important. And as a poet and as a writer and as a teacher of writing, I really appreciate that and the presence they have in the state.
Absolutely. And in fact, because this is Alaska Book Week, they have a website with different recordings of programs. This will be there as well.
Yeah. So yeah, there's events going on all week.
Yes. So take a look at that if you're interested in seeing authors or participating in any of the activities they have or getting involved. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks, Deb. Thanks for having me back. It's always fun to talk to you.
Oh, my gosh. This is a pleasure. What a treasure I have. Thank you so much for the book. Oh, my gosh. I feel blessed. You've been listening to an interview with Professor Shannon Gramsci and a fabulous poet. And his book is Last Poems. And where can people pick that up?
It's available, of course, on Amazon. If you'd rather not give Jeff Bezos your money, you can pick it up at Tidal Wave or a Writer's Block. I'll have a bunch of copies for sale on Wednesday night at Writer's Block. I think it's from 6 to 8 on Wednesday, the 15th.
The 15th?
Yeah, the 15th.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Autograph copies?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, awesome. Okay, you've been listening to Informania. Again, I've been talking with Professor Shannon Gramsci, writing professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage, great poet. And I want to remind you all, if you can imagine it, you can become it. Have a great week, everyone.